Welcome to the Female Lead Podcast, a place where we let women tell their stories and offer us their advice for life. With any luck, you'll find the conversation inspiring and uplifting, something I think we could all do with at the moment. I'm Bea Appleby, and today I'm talking to four brilliant women who are all entrepreneurs. We talk about taking the leap to start a business, as well as all the ups and downs and their secrets to success.
And every now and again, an idea comes along and just takes hold of you, and you're like, I've got to do it. And it was like I didn't have a choice. It really felt like this is where I need to be.
These four women set up their businesses in a little part of central London called Seven Dials. So they're all neighbours. We have Petra Barron. She's a street food market innovator who created Curb and then Seven Dials Market. We also have Alex Van Tornout, who is the founder of the stylish and inclusive athleisure brand Fashicize. Then Zoe Paskin, who runs the Barbary restaurant in Neil's Yard and is co-founder of the award-winning Soho restaurant, The Palomar. And finally, Anya Donovan, founder of They Made This, an affordable contemporary art store with shops in London and Brighton. Our conversation begins with their stories of starting out. So, here we go. So Petra, you touched on this just in your introduction. You talked about the chocolate van. It all started with you with buying an old ice cream van. What is the story?
The story is that I had been working on super yachts for years, for very rich people, and I was kind of going crazy. I was literally going insane working on those boats, even though I loved it. It came to a point where I had to leave. When I had this vision that I wanted to be in the food industry, I got back to London going, I don't know what that means, explored some options, hated those options. And then one day I had this idea that, oh, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to get a chocolate van and I'm going to drive it around the country and I'm going to sell chocolate from all the influences I've had from being around the world. And it's going to be amazing. I was so excited. And it was a big, big vision. And I was both terrified, but also more terrified of not doing it than doing it. And I went and bought this van on eBay from Scotland, drove it back, and was like, oh my God, what the hell do I do now? It was so terrifying. Like, to this day, it's the most terrifying thing I've ever done, because it felt like such a puncturing of like what I was already doing, and just driving around this big noisy diesel vehicle with a big noisy generator on the back, like blaring through the streets of Kensington. It just felt very kind of disruptive and like, oh, this isn't really kind of that cool. But at the same time, I was like, no, I think it's a good idea. And yeah, that was just me finding my spaces and just roaming and opening the hatch and meeting people from all over the place, all ages, all different backgrounds, and who all just love chocolate. And it was just a wonderful unifying experience. It was really fabulous, actually. Very hard work.
How did you get over, you said you were terrified by it, how did you get over that?
I was more terrified of not doing it than doing it. You know, when you just have this really powerful idea and this, like, I call it like the burning like fire in your belly, and you can't ignore it. Like we all have ideas all the time. Oh, I should do that. And most of them we don't bother doing anything about. And every now and again, an idea comes along and just takes hold of you, and you're like, I've got to do it. And it was like I didn't have a choice. It really felt like this is where I need to be. This is what I need to do. This feels like the culmination of everything I think is wonderful, like roaming around in a van, selling chocolate, making people happy, specifically meeting lots of different kinds of people, you know. Mm. For a long time in this country and all over the world, like, vendors, hawkers have not been legitimised, because unless you've got your own bricks and mortar, you're paying rent, you're paying business rates, and anyone that's kind of floating around between the buildings is sort of like a bit suspicious. And so you're out there, you're against the elements, you're literally rolling the dice every day as to whether you're going to make any money, or you're going to get rained out or winded out, or, you know, any other reason that can happen. And it creates this amazing bond amongst people of, there's a certain type of people that wants to make money on the streets, right? It's not for everyone. It's not very predictable. It's people who are happy to lug big old gas canisters around and set up gazebos in the wind and kind of like deal with the immediacy of, and of stress and reward of that comes with it. And just a lot of spirit. A lot of spirit and a lot of like raw entrepreneurialism that just was very infectious.
Yeah. And then you brought those people together with Curb.
Yeah.
Can you explain a bit about Curb and what that was? Is
Curb R.I.P. No. Curb was me just kind of sitting there one day and suddenly going, oh my god, we should bring everyone together. I'm really fed up of being an individual who's weak as one vendor who's able to be pushed around by events organizers and lose money and everything. Why don't we just get together, create strength in numbers, create more opportunities for ourselves, create more visibility. It felt like a time when I really felt like, you know, there's such an attitude around the world of people thinking British food is so bland and boring. I was like, no, there's something happening. There's great food, and if there's great food everywhere, and if people knew it, and if you know on the streets there's something happening, let's make it bigger, let's amplify it, let's agglomerate, let's cluster, and make it more of a thing. And that was really what it was, and it was a community I was in anyway. I was pushing against an open door. People were ready to do something and make something more of just being like one man bands everywhere. And just set it up really not even as a business initially, just as a community of people that wanted more and wanted to make more noise and wanted to make more impact.
And then you went on to create Seven Dials Market.
It was really about finding a home to bring in everything that we do on the streets under a roof in central London and serve it up in this kind of new but not new way for us. Gather great food and great people and just have a hub.
Let's move to one of your neighbours in the Seven Dials area, which is Alex, who is the founder of Fashicize. Hello. Hi. So did you have a similar, Petra was just talking about this burning sense of having an idea that you wanted to work on. Did you have something similar, or was it a more windy road for you?
Definitely more windy, but I would say probably everything I've done up until now, which is a bunch of things, but I sort of fell into it by accident in that, you know, I just tried something and then, oh, well, that's working out. And so prior to launching Fashicize, which I originally launched as a blog, I had my own blog. I was a journalist and I started writing my pieces online about, I think, 2007, which was the early days of blogging. And then somehow I find myself a couple of years later sitting front rows at the fashion shows. And, you know, none of this was planned. You know, I thought I was going to pursue a career in newspapers or magazines. And then suddenly this new thing happened and I happened to be there for it. So it was great. Like I rode that wave. And then with Fashicize, you know, I started writing about fitness on my own blog and I realized that a lot of people could relate to me, which is, you know, I'm not the, you know, typical marathon runner or all of that, but I wanted to enjoy myself doing active things. And I found that, you know, the fashion around it was really boring. And as someone who worked in fashion, why would I go into a class, which I pay £20 for, and look the same as everybody else? So I started looking at, you know, different brands, and I noticed that there was this sort of little wave emerging of young designers who were trying to do something different, and that there was something other than the big brands like Nike and Adidas out there. And I started writing about them. And then within a couple of weeks' time, I was just like, you know, one drunken night, I was like, I should sell them. If nobody else is, I should sell them. And then, you know, it all took off from there. And a couple of months later, we relaunched as a retailer. And that was 7 years ago. So, you know, it wasn't a plan. But I knew the minute that I sort of started it and just felt the feedback from people that I had to do it because nobody else was doing it. So, yes, I followed that gut instinct. But I would say that probably I sort of fell into it as well.
Now, I want to move on to Zoe. Zoe, you are the managing director of the Barbary and co-founder of the Palomar, and you studied psychology and you thought about becoming a criminal psychologist, and then you started working in nightclubs and then became a restaurateur. Can you just explain how that all worked?
Well, I was originally hoping to somehow either work in the therapy or clinical route. Life's always a bit of kind of the number of things that happen to you along the way in forming your decision. So I was fascinated by psychology. I went to university, I came out, I wanted to learn another language. So I went off to Barcelona with a suitcase. Didn't learn an awful lot of Spanish, but my brother then had set up the End nightclub, which was probably a little bit ahead of its time. So it was like this amazing cutting edge dance music venue, very close to Seven Dials. So my Seven Dials story began in 1995. And it was amazing, but the dance floor was great, but the business side of it, you know, took quite a long time to come together, which is often the way with very young entrepreneurs. And there'd always been quite a big age gap between us, so I didn't feel particularly like the seriously taken younger sister. Anyway, cut to a tour in Ibiza, and it was very obvious the stress, and I offered to help. And I went back about a week later for a month from Barcelona, and I quickly learned that my sort of practical side, my empathy, my engagement with people, my interest in psychology, how a space works, how an atmosphere works, meant that I was sort of doing quite a good job quite quickly. And a month became, I'll do it till Christmas, it was August at the time, and I ended up taking over the running of the company. I became the managing director, and over 10 years we paid back all the debt and had an amazing time, and really did end up designing a culture that could work for the business, that sat alongside the sort of more underground feel of the nightclub. It changed the course of my life. I think I probably would have probably ended up staying in Barcelona for quite a long time and learning some Spanish eventually. It was a journey. I mean, it took a while. The debt was, you know, over £1.5 million when I got there, but we did eventually pay it all back and ended up issuing dividends. I mean, it was a long journey. But an amazing one. You know, it's very different, the world of dance music, to the world of restaurant and hospitality, where I find myself now. And people really followed the artists, the venue with a kind of, it was like part of their life in a different way. I mean, people adore certain restaurants and chefs and so on. I wouldn't say that is there, obviously, but I think something like the End, you know, when we close, and I still get it to this day, people feel like, you know, something ended in their lives when we brought the End to an end.
It's interesting what you're saying then, because I read an interview with you, you were saying how with a club, someone might not like one night, but they might come back again to see it for a different kind of night. But with a restaurant, you've got one chance to make an impression. How does that impact how you work?
It is very, very, very different. I think in many ways, I mean, how we came to the decision to not continue the club, and now looking back, I mean, the benefit of hindsight, there is a certain magic to designing any atmosphere. It could be your own dinner party, but when you're doing it for 1,000 people, or that everyone is sort of part of the improvisation. That's true in a restaurant space, but the moments of truth from when they first make the reservation or walk in to go on the waiting list to leaving the building, there are so many moments where the restaurant could perceivably get it wrong. So getting it right is amazing, but the other way around is challenging, and it's a little bit wearing, because if overall the restaurant's getting it right, people are very quick, I think, to perhaps not be so forgiving and not realise that it is a bit of a two-way street. It is our job to give them the best experience, the best food, but we are all part of what makes a great dinner party. And I think that's a little bit truer of restaurants than meets the eye.
So let's move on to Onya. So talking about the story of how you founded They Made This, which is about selling affordable and contemporary art. Am I right in thinking that this is still a side hustle for you?
It is.
Yeah. How's that work?
Not always very well, if I'm totally honest. Yeah, so so my journey's a little bit different again. It's so wonderful hearing everybody's stories. I certainly never set out to be an entrepreneur or a businesswoman. Actually, I never woke up one day and said, I'm going to, you know, do this. I studied photography at university. And then I did a bit of work with Time Out, and I did some work as a photographer's agent. Well, I assisted. I was a bit of a dog's body, actually, as a photographer's agent. And a waitress tons and bartended loads for years, which was great, actually. I really enjoyed it. It was very hard work, but I really learned a lot from that. And then I fell into advertising, actually, which, again, I'd never sort of intended to do. I heard about this job where you could commission photographers and illustrators. And because of my photography background, I thought, that's a brilliant job. You can work with artists all the time and, you know, commit award jobs to them. And then that allows them to, that buys them time to, you know, work on all their personal projects. And I thought it was a wonderful job. And I managed very luckily to get into it. And I started, I was 30. So actually, nearly everybody, I was the team assistant, like the sort of PA, essentially. And nearly everybody in the team was much younger than me and more experienced than me, which was hilarious. And so, but that did give me quite a lot of drive, actually, to sort of succeed. And then I did it for about 8 years. I still do it now, but I was doing it for about 8 years. And then I realized that I wanted something of my own. So I set up the side hustle on the side, which was actually, like Alex, it was a blog. I started blogging about all the photographers and illustrators that I was working with all the time. I mean, I had access to the most amazingly talented people. And then people started emailing me and saying, you know, that print you were talking about with that artist, is it for sale? And I was like, oh, no, let me ask them. So I became like this middle person, like sort of, you know, talking to customers potentially and artists. And then I was like, oh, well, and they were like, oh, no, I hadn't thought about selling it. And I was like, well, why don't we do a limited edition print run? And then, you know, so it kind of grew really organically. Like, I never set out this action plan, you know. I somehow haven't done the thing that everyone else here has done, which I'm so envious of and sort of so in awe of, which is to jump off the cliff and run with this business. It's a struggle in my head to go there. I need more confidence and I need to take more risks, I think, to do that.
Well, let's talk about taking risks then. I mean, I think it's really interesting what you're saying about not taking that leap, because I interviewed Bobby Brown a few months ago and I was asking her advice for women who want to start their own businesses, and she said, you know, don't think that you have to do this huge leap. Start a side hustle, you know, start that. Don't give up your day job necessarily. See how it goes. And that kind of is a less overwhelming way of thinking about starting your own business. And it's really good to hear your story, which is this sort of not taking the leap, but also that it's working. But let's talk about taking risks. So there is a lot of risk involved in starting your own business. And how do you all feel about risk-taking, how you find the courage to do it, and what do you think about the perception that women aren't good at taking risks?
I have never had a 9-to-5 job. And for me, I think I've always known, you know, I was a freelance journalist, and I've always known that for me, the thing I didn't want to get into was into this 9-to-5 career path that I would be stuck in and too scared to leave, you know. And I understand what you're saying, like having that fallback is great, but for me it was never something that I really wanted to go into. So for me that was the hardest choice, is actually I don't want to go to that point. So what do I need to do to avoid that from happening? So I've been very lucky in that, you know, I did have that ability to do, because I already had something to fall back on, which is freelance writing, whilst doing this on the side. And then it just kind of, one day I was like, right, this is now the focus. But if it doesn't work out, nothing lost, and we can continue what I was doing before. But I think there is that moment where you have to make a choice, which is, you know, all the career or whatever you've built for yourself, you're going to drastically change that. And that is going to affect your family life, and that is going to affect your, you know, friendships, because obviously for me, running my own business affects my daily life. I'm often working on weekends. And so it is this big moment. And I think, you know, maybe as women, we are maybe a little less inclined to take that, because we do have maybe more to think about, which is, I was lucky I did it quite young. But, you know, if there are kids running around, you know, then that is such a big moment. But I think for me, the harder part would have been not taking that risk, because then I knew that I would have had to take a normal job. And that's something I try to avoid. So it's, so far it's worked out.
That resonates a lot with me, because I think some of the times I've been faced with big risks, you know, choices, dilemmas, either within like, shall I do this, like this particular thing or not, it's often been a motivator to be very aware of, if I don't do it, then this version of this might be what it is. Whereas if I take the risk, this is what it could look like. You never really know exactly, but it will take you down the next steps of a particular path. I think your attitude to risk or any negotiation has to come down to whether you are okay enough with if it doesn't work out. And that could be whether you're pushing it in a conversation with somebody or deciding to take a business leap. Obviously, stages of life are relevant. Some of the scenarios I found myself in my 20s, saving and working at the club, are very different to perhaps the conversation I'd have now, 20 years later. Doesn't mean I wouldn't take risks, but they would be different. I also have a small child. You have to calculate how the scenario weighs with where you are at that moment in your life or in the imminent future. It's very easy to glamorize in some way what it is to be an entrepreneur. At the same time, of course, there is an upside. You know, I wouldn't want to get too bogged down in the last 12 months, but at the end of the day, probably quite a lot of people who are on furlough are anxious and maybe don't have so many other resources, but they know that's what's happening. Whereas as the entrepreneur, I have to think about the constant moving sands of what it might look like, probably particularly an entrepreneur in hospitality. So there's always pressure, whether it's about how to make the business go above the line, how to get it right for the staff, the customer, we're people at both ends. So it's hard work running your own business, but of course there are moments where it is flourishing and there's a sense of freedom and, you know, bountifulness, I think.
This episode is sponsored by one of London's most beautiful neighbourhoods, Seven Dials. Seven Dials is made up of seven interconnecting streets lined with an abundance of independent shops and award-winning restaurants, waiting for your visit when safe to do so. If you haven't already been to Seven Dials, I thoroughly recommend a stroll through this truly authentic village, where you'll also discover the colourful Neil's Yard, one of my favourite hidden treasures for our fresco dining. Doesn't that sound like a dream? Now, back to the show.
Petra, as someone who's had a few different ventures, does it get easier to, does it get less terrifying when you start something new, or is it always the same?
I think it's always the same, but it's also less terrifying. I think you become more and more confident that with the risk come the rewards. And I think, you know, back to what Alex was saying, I was thinking, you know, what you were saying, I was thinking that the risk is in not acting on the thing that is inside you. And I think about that Thoreau quote, you know, most of us are leading lives of quiet desperation and die with our songs still inside us. And like, I don't want that to be me. And I think if you think about that stuff, you act and you jump. And what I've learned that is so amazing about when you take a risk and you do something that truly moves you, is it's so electric that the transmission is received so well by everybody else that everyone else sort of jumps in and helps you and carries you along. Like, I couldn't believe it when I started. I mean, the chocolate van is, it seems so silly because it was just a food truck, but it was such a big moment for me. But I remember I spent a lot of time in the States, and I remember thinking, God, I don't know if they're really that encouraging of entrepreneurship in Britain like they are in the States. I don't know if people are going to be like that behind it. And I was so pleasantly surprised when I started speaking it into existence and telling people I'm going to do this thing. And I was so excited, and, you know, enthusiasm is 80% of all sales and everything like that. And I was like, oh, I'm going to do this thing. And people were so into it, and they were so up for helping me, and so kind of taken by someone taking a risk, that you hold on to that, and you know that that's a thing. And it's like, whenever I talk to new businesses or people about to start a business, I'm like, you've got to just connect to that feeling and take that jump, because you will be caught, and you're not going to let yourself fall. And that's the thing. And I to this day I still am like, oh, I need to take another risk, I'm ready to take another jump. And I hear what you're saying, Una, like it's like a standing on that precipice. Is it going to be all right? Is it not going to be all right? But it will be all right. And you have to remember that.
Yeah, it's so funny, those things that you said. You're so right about how people sort of buoy you with, when you're enthusiastic, they're enthusiastic too. Like, I think, you know, you've caught me at this moment where I really am on that precipice. It's really interesting talking to all of you today, because I think even a year ago, I wasn't quite there. I was mainly online, and it's sort of easier in a way to run a business that is online. I mean, obviously, it's still very demanding, but you can kind of do the juggle a bit more. And meeting people like Emma Steele at Shaftesbury, and also I have a store in Brighton as well. I have one on the lanes in Brighton, so I've got two. I mean, they're both closed now, but I have two stores. And, you know, that was another group of, and they're all women, actually. It was a group of women who found out about me and kind of got caught up in the enthusiasm of the community of artists that I work with. And just actually, without them, I wouldn't probably be having these physical shops.
Well, I'm excited that this could be the day when you decide to make the leap. This podcast could be the moment you talk about later in life, hopefully.
I hope so. My boss in advertising will hate this so much, but also probably be quite pleased for
me. So, we've been talking about enthusiasm and energy and taking risks. That just came up quite a lot. So those are some things. But what are the other things that you think are key to a successful business for you?
Passion. I mean, you know, for me, I don't think I could put myself through what it takes to run a business and deal with the daily challenges if I didn't truly love what I did. And I've always said, the day I stop loving it, I'm done, because it is so much to take on that if you don't truly you know, believe in what you're doing, and if it's just a job, then please, like, I would always tell people, don't do it if it's not something that you can see yourself in 5 years time waking up and going, let's do this. And I think for me, that's the main driver, is I truly love what I do and what I've built. And the day that changes, I'm happy to leave.
And a lot of perseverance alongside it, because the passion is amazing, right? And the passion is what gets you naive enough to think that you want to start a business in the first place. It's like, we're all total rookies, aren't we? We're like, and then you always look back and go, oh my God, I had no idea it was going to be like this. I wouldn't have started it in a million years if I'd have known, kind of things. It's so sort of different to, you imagine, so you get off the blocks, but then the perseverance is just like, in knowing that it just takes a freaking long time to really get there and to keep on, you know, doing it. And it's relentless. And also people, you know, not underestimating the power of human relationships, and just from everybody, whether it's your team, whether it's your suppliers, whether it's your customers, just how you treat people and how you get on with people and how you gel, because again, it's like it's an ecosystem, isn't it? Everyone sort of helps each other out, and you've got to like be able to flow within that. And I hadn't realized before I started a business just how important human relationships are to, and good, obviously good human relationships are to maintaining your business.
I'm writing down a really good list here. We could put it on a t-shirt. Energy, enthusiasm, risk, passion, perseverance, and people. And what else?
I'll turn it into a print and we can put it in the shop, because it sounds fantastic. So you've just got yourself your first print. Well done. That's brilliant.
Zoe, did you have another word you were going to say, or another thing?
Preparation, because I think that whatever type of business you're embarking on and running, constantly crafting the idea, what it looks like, how it feels, how it gets presented, marketed, enjoyed. I think preparation is a big one, and that's an ongoing thing. It goes from preparation to attention to detail for me, and that doesn't ever stop, really.
What advice would you give to women who feel that they could start a business but they don't know where to begin?
I think reaching out to other people, and I mean, I think right now social media has made it quite easy to reach out to other female entrepreneurs, and I have like my little private network where we all just share our war stories and all of that. And I think maybe a couple of years ago that wasn't as readily available, but I think just reach out. If you have an idea, a lot of people are willing to help you, but you've got to ask. if you're sitting at home and just kind of going over this thing and should I, shouldn't I, you know, nobody's going to know about it. But actually just starting to talk to people and say, look, I've got this idea and you know, I don't know where to begin and would it work? And just finding people who might understand what it takes. And sometimes it's a tiny bit of advice that when, you know, will change like or get you started and taking that leap. And I think, yeah, just talk to other people who've been through it.
I found as soon as I started to share this idea that I had, whether it was I'm just going to do a blog or I'm thinking about doing a shop, it grew from other people's input. And I think looking back, if I kept it all to myself, it just wouldn't be what it is now. Like, it's all about community and collaboration for me and talking to artists and getting their opinions. Because, of course, I've got about 50 artists in our shop and they are my business, really. Yes, I run it, but without them, there is no business. And without talking to them and developing their work, and we sort of grow together, you know. And I've got the best advice from women in particular. Actually, I've really found that women, and I'm not just saying this because it's International Women's Day, but it is true. At key junctures of my life, women have been the people who've influenced me the most and pushed me forward the most.
I agree with both of you. There's a power that comes with speaking something out loud, and you speak it into existence and people hear it and then they pick up on what you're putting down, and then it becomes an energy out there in the world that if you keep it to yourself, it's never going to get released. And as soon as you start saying something, it and almost just like kind of backing yourself and committing those words to the airwaves, it you kind of feel like, okay, it's a thing now, and people ask you about it and they're like, oh, so what's happening with such and such? You're like, oh, okay, I'm gonna do it, kind of thing. And it carries outwards.
And you're held accountable then. I always find this really interesting. You're like, I'm going to do this thing. And you tell all your mates, right? And then the next time you see them in the pub, when we were allowed to go to the pub, they were like, so what's going on with the thing? And you're like, oh God, yeah, I forgot about that. Or like, it's brilliant because your mates and all those people who care about you will hold you accountable. They're like, that's a good idea. You've got to do it. And it is encouraging. So openness is so important, but it's hard to do. It's hard to take that step and say, I've had an idea and I think it might be good, because it's hard to be confident enough that someone's not going to laugh at you, but like, oh, some so-and-so's done that or whatever. And that might be the case. And it's good to know that early on, because you need to know about your competitors, you know, you need to know who's doing stuff too.
You will soon all be reopening, fingers crossed. And we'll all be down there eating and buying and having fun in Seven Dials. Why did you all choose to set up in Seven Dials? What do you love about it?
I liked the fact that, you know, we're an independent shop and we stock independent brands, and everyone around us is similar. And so we're all sort of facing that. What I love about, you know, and the fact that we're all sat here, a lot of us are the business owners who are actually on the premises every day. We're not, you know, huge corporations with a head office controlling all of it. Like, so many of the shops around there, you walk in there and the founder is there, and it's so personal. And I think you feel that when you go around the shops, it's so personal to the people who are there. So for me, it was just, the perfect match.
I'm also on Monmouth Street, and it's a beautiful cobblestone street with wonderful independent brands. And I cannot wait to open up those doors again. I'm slightly luckier in some ways because I have an online shop and I can certainly continue on trading in that way. So, you know, so very grateful for that. But there's nothing like a bricks and mortar store. There's nothing like walking in and seeing all the art in one place. You never get that experience online. You're just clicking on one thing and then on the other, and it's, you just don't get the same energy. And we do a lot of workshops, like free art workshops, screen printing and collage and plasticine and you name it. And those experiences, I miss that energy so much, because all these people together just making art, and we usually try to put them on for free or very, very like a fiver maybe or something. And there's nothing in the world like that.
I think it's the bones of the place as well, you know, like the actual dial, the architecture of the dial, and the way that those streets coming off it, like cheese wedges coming off it, was designed for maximum rental, to create maximum rental, because it had so much frontage, and rents were charged on frontage, and so it affected the architecture. So you got these wedges. So Seven Dials Market is literally a wedge coming out of the dial, and they were going to trash it all, weren't they, after Covent Garden Market moved in the 70s. They were going to bulldoze it all, and the residents were like, no, you can't, you've got to look after it. So there's this real sort of like heritage thing there. And you know, the reason that we went for the banana logo was because it was a banana warehouse, and all around the market were these warehouses that were storing fruit and veg to service the market. Pineapple Studios is called Pineapple Studios because it was a pineapple pineapple storage space. And it's just so fun. Like, you go to a place and you're like, right, we're us, but how do we become part of this place? And you do your research and you're like, God, this place is just gold. These were like, this was Gin Alley around here. This was proper Hogarthian, crazy stuff. They used to pillage people at the dial. Like, people were killed for, you know, perjury or whatever at the dial, with being thrown like bottles and old rats and cauliflowers and stuff. I mean, there's the most gruesome stories. And you're there and you're like part of the patina of the place, and you're feeling it, and you're bringing it back to life and bringing it into the modern day, and that the architecture of the space allows for that, and the, you know, the running of it, and the all the different businesses within it kind of just contribute to the extra additional layers. And it's just lovely being part of the bones of that place.
You definitely feel the history, don't you? I love that you called Cucumber Alley Cucumber Alley, because then I read a story about how that's what it was sort of called originally, and you brought all that back. And because it's cobblestoned, and you go there and you feel so much history, and it's wonderful to be part of that and to see it be so independent again. And I've always loved Seven Dials. When I first moved to London back in 1997, I used to go to Pop Boutique, which was on Monmouth Street at the time, and you'd go and get great vintage clothes there. For me, it just feels like I've made it. I'm like, I'm on Monmouth Street. Oh my God, I'm never leaving. I think it's a wonderful place.
You have made it.
I have made it.
It's official.
Okay. Okay, I'll quit my job now.
Yeah, exactly. Please make this the moment. So before we finish, because I have to let you go, can you just give me your best piece of advice that you've ever received? Go, Zoe.
Your first instincts are from heaven, so follow them.
That is great. I love it. So true. Who's next? Alex, I can see you're burning.
Well, no, I mean, I've said it before, but for me it was, you know, if you no longer wake up in the morning and love what you do, then walk away. And I think when running an own business, if you don't have the energy and the love for it, then it's not yours to be doing, probably.
Petra?
I think for me, I mean, God, so many bits of advice, but I think for me, probably it's not what happens to you, it's how you deal with what happens to you. And it's like it takes it away from victim behavior. Like, it's very easy in life to go, oh God, I can't believe this happened to me, and you know, why, and kind of put the blame or whatever elsewhere. And actually, you've got the ability and the power to control. The only thing you can control in the world is how you respond. And I think it's just really important to remember, especially given the year we've all just had or whatever, like, it's anything can happen. You cannot get hung up on what's happened. You have to just focus on, okay, what are you going to do about it?
That's really good, and a great place to end. Okay, thank you so much, all of you. That has just been such an inspiring conversation. I'm going to now go and start my own business.
Well, if you need any advice, we're here for you. Come and trade at Cucumber Alley.
Yeah, I'd love to. So that's it. I hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back with another female lead podcast very soon. In the meantime, check out our socials across all social platforms. And also, you could try our other podcast called The Making Of, available in all the places you might get your podcast. So, see you next time.